Welcome to the USU podcast, now reaching earbuds in over 175 countries and growing. I'm Julie Riesler, an interior designer for your soul. I'm a master life coach, author of Get a PhD in You, founder of the Life Designer Coach Academy, professor at Georgetown University, and host of this powerful show. I created this show because I believe you are meant to expand, evolve, and express yourself fully as your most authentic, extraordinary, truest USU. That dream that lives within you, it's meant to manifest. Tune in with me to hear life-changing conversations with leading experts, spiritual luminaries, and fellow entrepreneurs and creatives to help guide you back to your divine self, to your inherent worthiness, your sacred purpose, your right to prosperity and full health, and your ability to do, be, or have whatever lights you up the most. This podcast will help you live a life that's designed by your soul and not your fear. Now that we've got that clear, I'm just going to remind you one more time. You were born to fully be your USU. It's your time. Are you ready to join me on this journey? Let's do it. Hello, USU family, community, all souls all over the world. I am so excited to be here with you and share one of my just an amazing guest. I've been really excited to have you get to be part of this conversation. So I'm going to tell you all about Dr. John DeMartini, and I am certain many of you probably have already read some of his books, know about his work. We're really going to get deep today, talking about all kinds of ways to help you truly actualize and express your most authentic, genuine, prosperous self, your USU. So let me tell you about Dr. John DeMartini. He is a world-renowned specialist in human behavior, a researcher, author, and global educator. Dr. Martini has authored 40 books, you heard me correctly, that have been translated into 39 different languages, and has shared the stage with some of the world's most influential people, including Sir Richard Branson, Stephen Covey, Deepak Chopra, Wayne Dyer, Steve Wozniak, and so many others. He has developed a series of solutions applicable across all markets, all sectors, and age groups, which he has presented as a welcomed guest on Larry King Live, CNN, CNBC, and as a contributor to Oprah Magazine and hundreds of other magazines. International bestselling author of The Values Factor and 39 other books, Dr. DeMartini has studied over 299 academic disciplines through the last 48 years. I love the commitment and the time that you've spent building your wisdom. And we're going to talk all today about revolving around maximizing human potential, human awareness, and leadership. As a global educator, he is the founder of the DeMartini Institute and has worked with entrepreneurs, board members, and CEOs at companies including IBM, Shell Oil, Merrill Lynch, and so many more. He has helped thousands of people transform their life according to their highest values to create their life masterpiece. I love that. We'll have all of the links below. You can definitely learn more at drdemartini.com, and we'll make sure to have those in the show notes. All right. So I'm reading that and I'm like, what a gift to have you here. Thank you. Thank you for being here. I already have so many questions. Just thank you for your presence and the beautiful work you're doing. So I always like to start with a little bit of backstory and a little bit of background, because I know you've been doing this 48 years. Is not like you didn't just start this yesterday. I'm curious, Dr. DeMartini, did you grow up thinking like, I want to study human potential and leadership? Like, how did you even get into this world, this realm, this whole study of human, of human capacity and leadership?
I was born in 1954. I had an arm and leg deformity.
Oh, wow.
And a speech and mouth deformity. When I was about a year and a half, I had to wear braces on an arm and leg on the left side and had to go and use buttons and strings in my mouth to exercise muscles. So I had a bit of a speech issue. And when I got to first grade, they were trying to teach me how to read. And no matter what I did, it wasn't working. So I had sort of dyslexia. And no matter what I did, I couldn't make any sense out of the words. So I had to wear a dunce cap. They had a dunce cap in 1960. And my parents had to come to the school. My teacher had to say to them, with me there, saying that, "I'm afraid your son will never be able to read. He'll probably never be able to write effectively or communicate effectively. Probably won't go very far in life, probably won't amount to much. But since he's come out of these braces that I was told he was in, he just wants to run. So gear him into sports so he can have some place he can do okay." So I ended up making it through elementary school by asking the smartest kids questions. And I did. I was able to somehow get through the elementary years by asking the smartest kids, because if I heard something, I could make some sort of sense out of it, but I couldn't spell and read and write. I left school when my parents moved from Houston, Texas to Richmond, Texas. I didn't have a bunch of smart kids. It was a real low socioeconomic area. Mm. So I dropped out of school. I left home at 13. As a street kid, and first lived in Houston, lived in the beach. Then at 14, I hitchhiked out to California, hung around Huntington Beach, California, and Southern California, and down into Mexico illegally. At 15, I panhandled enough money to fly to Hawaii. I lived under a bridge there, then in a park bench, then a park bathroom, and then an abandoned car, and finally into a tent. I kept social climbing, and I was a surfer. And I had long-haired beard surfing kind of thing in the late 60s. At age 17, I almost died. And in the recovery of that, I was led to a health food store and a yoga class to try to get nutrition in me and to try to learn how to have mind over body. At a yoga class, there was a guest speaker there named Paul Bragg. And Paul Bragg, one night, 1 hour, with one message, spoke in such a manner that made me believe that maybe I could someday overcome my learning problems. And maybe I could be someday intelligent and be able to speak properly and read properly. That night, my life changed. He took us through this guided imagery meditation experience. And I saw something that night, epiphany, of me standing in front of this giant audience speaking. Must have been a dissociative identity disorder or something. I was the farthest thing from my mind at the time. But that night I saw that vision. And then I said, I would love to be able to do that. And after what he said, it made me believe that I could somehow work and overcome my problems and get there. I then started studying with this man for 3 weeks. Every morning I hitchhiked where he was and I would listen to him. And I learned some tools on how to move forward. He told me that I would say to myself, because I had a learning problem, to say, "I'm a genius and I apply my wisdom." He said, if I say that every single day, sooner or later, the cells in my body will tingle with it, so will the world. So I started saying that every day. I then flew back to Los Angeles, hitchhiked back to Texas, and went back to see my parents when the surf came down. My parents taught me into taking a GED, high school equivalency test, because they thought it would help me get a job if I needed a job. And miraculously, by saying this, "I'm a genius, I'm a wisdom," or something, or just maybe coincidence, I somehow passed this test. And I had me a high school degree without ever going to high school. And it was just guessing. I closed my eyes and I just said that affirmation. I just guessed and that, boom, I passed this test some miraculous way. I don't know how to describe it, except somehow I was led intuitively to answer the right little blackened dots with a pencil. My parents then suggest, "Well, since the surf is down, why don't you try to go to college, take a college entrance?" So I tried to go to college, and I needed a 72 to pass. I got a 27. I failed. And I remember driving home from that test, crying. And I curled up on a fetal position in the living room, and I thought, all I could hear is my first grade teacher talking. And I thought, there's no way this is going to happen. This is an illusion. My mom came home from shopping and she said, "What happened, son?" She saw me crying. "What happened? What happened?" I said, "I blew the test. I guess I don't have what it takes. I guess I'll never read or write or communicate, etc." And she said something that only a mom could say. She took her hand and put it on my shoulder. And she said, "Son, whether you become a great teacher and travel the world like you dream, whether you return to Hawaii and ride giant waves like you've done, or you return to the streets and panhandle as a bum, which you've also done, I just want to let you know that your father and I are going to love you no matter what you do, boy." Mm-hmm. When she said that, my hand went into a fist. And I said to myself, "I'm going to master this thing called reading and learning. I'm going to master this thing called speaking and teaching. And I'm going to do whatever it takes. I'm going to travel whatever distance. I'm going to pay whatever price to give my service of love across this planet. I'm not going to let any human being on the face of the earth stop me, not even myself." I got up. I went to my mom. I hugged her. I thanked her. I went into my room. I got the dictionary out, a little Funkin' Wagnalls dictionary, which I still have. And I memorized 30 words a day. And my mom would test me on spelling, pronunciation, using it in a sentence, the meaning. And I worked very hard, spent the day learning 30 words a day until my vocabulary was strong enough where I was able to pass school, learn how to read. And then once I did, I started living in encyclopedias, dictionaries, and I started reading. When I turned 19, my mom said, "What do you want for your birthday?" I said, "Mom, I want the greatest teachings on the face of the earth by the greatest writers who ever lived from around the world." She said, "You sure you don't want a t-shirt?" I said, "No, Mom, I want the greatest writings." So she said, "Okay, let me see what I can do." So she got her brother, who was an MIT professor, a chemist and physicist, and asked, "What do we do? John's learning how to read." And he sent 2 6-by-6-by-6-foot wooden crates of books in every imaginable field as a gift down to our house. Came on a flatbed truck. They put it on the ground. I got a Recrobar out, and I opened that, those boxes up and filled my rooms with books. Just filled them, stacked it. And I went to work. And I started learning every word I didn't know. I got a dictionary out. I got specialized dictionaries for different fields. And I just went there and I just made a commitment that I would spend 18 to 20 hours a day on this every day until I was excelling. And slowly but surely, people wanted me to go and to actually now answer questions for them. And my speaking career started before I turned 19. I was 18. And here it is now 50 years later. 48 is 2 years ago. I'm now 50 years in just a few weeks, 2.5 weeks will be my 50th year of speaking. So I've gotten to speak now 181 countries. I made a commitment to go to every country on the face of the earth. I've gotten to speak in 181 countries because I've been on a mission for the last 50 years.
Wow. That's a remarkable story. And one of the things that I think, I mean, I can feel just the, it feels even 50 years later, it's still so present. I can see it. I can hear it in you. And that passion, I mean, when I was reading about all the books you've written and going through them and remembering like, oh yeah, I remember this one. And it's just, it's remarkable. The thing you said that I think really stuck out at me is you said, "I decided not to let anyone, including myself, get in the way."
Yeah, it's where some people call divine providence meets human sovereignty. Mm-hmm. It's where there's no option. Mm-hmm. Give yourself an option not to fulfill what you're here for.
Yeah. I'm curious because there's so many, just in looking through your books and so many of these different topics, including, I know, you know, the values factor. I mean, you have so much that you go through, the gratitude effect, inspired destiny, riches within, like, and I know we can't go through all of them yet. I would love to start with this divine destiny, this decision, this no other option, because, you know, for you, it was so extreme, right? It really, I mean, just, I'm amazed. First of all, I actually can't believe that was a struggle because you speak so beautifully. I'm like, I don't hear anything. I mean, I know it's been quite a bit of time, yet it's just such a testament to what's possible when you make that decision. And I'm thinking for those of my listeners who might be feeling like I don't have as dire a situation yet. You know, it's almost, you know, I want to do this. I want to live out my dream, but I have this going on. Like, what are the ingredients to making that non-negotiable decision? I guess to start there.
Every human being, regardless of age or gender or culture, lives moment by moment by a set of priorities or values, things that are most or least important in their life. And that hierarchy of values is fingerprint specific to them. And even though it does evolve and change through time, it's still at that moment impacting how you perceive, decide, and act. And those are the three things we have control over in life, nothing else. And so if you set an objective, something to attend to or intend, if it is aligned and congruent with the very top value, the thing that's most meaningful, inspiring, fulfilling, and really your ontological identity revolves around, you will excel. And you will wake up a momentum-building, incremental, driven, momentum-building system that will be unstoppable. If you set a goal, attention, intention, that is aligned with lower values, you'll tend to procrastinate, hesitate, frustrate, because you'll need some sort of extrinsic motivator to keep you moving. Your highest value is intrinsically called. Your lower value is extrinsically pushed. And if you're not living congruently with the highest values, you'll feel the world's against you instead of for you. You'll feel it's in the way instead of on the way. And you'll feel that you'll have to have motivation from the outside. Motivation is a symptom, never a solution for human beings. Being inspired intrinsically from within is where it's at. And that's the calling, as theologians have sometimes called it. And there is such a thing. I've been for 45 of the 50 years of teaching, working with human values. And I have developed a value determination process that gets past the fluff. Because if you ask somebody what their values are, they'll tell you a bunch of social idealisms, their mothers, their fathers, their preachers, their teachers, their conventions, their traditions, their mores around them, the external sources of how to fit into the world instead of what you're called to do. You know, if you're really fitting into the world, you're not going to make a difference because you're being like everybody else. But the real calling is something that makes a difference. We all want to make a difference, which means we all have a yearning to want to be authentic. And our authentic self is what revolves around what we value most. So giving ourselves permission to identify what that is, and then having the structure to structure our life according to that, and start filling our day with highest priority actions so it doesn't fill up with low priority distractions, is very powerful in changing the course and destiny of people. And it doesn't matter where you've been, doesn't matter what you come from or gone through, all of that has to be as that. Now, I was blessed that night I met Paul Bragg to discover that. But I've helped thousands of people discover what that is and take off. And they don't necessarily have to have traumas or challenges to find it. But your life demonstrates what you really value. If you have a drone looking over you and look carefully at your life, every decision you make is based on it. So what happens is the thing that makes it difficult is people compare themselves to others, put other people on pedestals, think they know more than them. They brain offload decisions to other people, and then they cloud the clarity of their own purpose. And then they start questioning themselves and they self-depreciate, trying to be somebody they're not instead of honor who they are. Why be second at being anybody else? Why not be first at being you?
Well, I got chills. You're speaking not just my language, this, you know, I think a place to start, because what I'm really hearing is it's really about your highest value. And are you living aligned with that? And you've created this value, you know, determination process. I'm wondering, for those listening, could we talk a little bit about that process and help? I just, you know, I can hear, how do I know? How do I know it's my top? I have five, they go together. Because I think to even create the structure, first you've got to know, okay, what is your top values? Could we start there? That would be amazing.
Yes. Okay. And on my website, drdmartini.com, there is a complimentary, free complimentary, private value determination process they do. So I've already put it online. I figure this is, if there's any contribution I can make it to put that out there in the world.
Amazing.
And I've been doing that a long time and developing that. So, but there are criteria. So I'd like to go through those if you don't mind.
Absolutely. And we'll have the links to everything. And everyone's like, don't worry, we got you. Everything will be in the show notes with all of these links. But yes, let's start with the criteria.
Okay. So first of all, when I asked people 45 years ago, what exactly are your values? Because I noticed some people would say they want to do something and they don't do it. And other people would do it. So what's the distinction? Why are some people walking their talk and some people living their life? So I noticed the difference. And I asked people what their values are. And I found out that 99.99999% of the people think they know, but they don't. Mm. They're so inculcated by the injected values of outside forces that they've clouded it. And they'll tell you peace and harmony and truth and, you know, all the idealisms. But then when I look at their life, I see a different world. So I'm not interested in what you say. I'm interested in what you're living. Your actions speak louder than your words is an old proverb. So I had to go through and get past the BS and get to what exactly it is with neuroscience. And I've been back in, I started teaching neurology back in my early 20s. So I've got a lot of background. I'm working on a textbook on neurology right now. But one thing I looked at is the first determinant of an individual's values is their space. We have in proxemics an intimate space, which is about a foot and a half. We got a personal space, which is about 4 feet. We got a more of a social space, which is maybe 10 to 12 feet. And then we got a public space, which is beyond that. Things that are really important to you, you keep proximal. And things that are not important to you, you push distal. So something proximal is something in your personal or intimate space. And something that's not important goes out, pushes away. So if I gave you some trash, you would push it away. But if I gave you a 10-carat diamond ring, you could bring it close. Makes any sense. Particularly a female. Yeah. So if I gave you $1 billion cash, you'd keep it close. You wouldn't push it away. But if I gave you some toxic uranium, you'd push it away. So space indicates what you, in your filter, value and allow in or out. You have a bias to bring it in when it's valuable and push it out. So I look at what do you fill your space with most? What are the top three items that are within a foot and a half of you, no more than 4 feet, within reach, that you have in your space most of the time where you hang out most? So if I look carefully, I'm literally a foot and a half away from my computer right now. I spend most of my day in front of my computer either teaching or researching and writing. So if I look carefully at what my life demonstrates, those are important. I spend most of my day teaching, researching, and writing. So I look at what's in my space, and it's a computer. Then I look at what else is in my space. Well, I got a phone here. And if I look at what is the dominant use of my computer, teaching, what's the dominant use of my phone? Believe it or not, looking stuff up, researching when I'm not at my computer. I love learning. So if I look at what my space reveals, I'm surrounding my space within my reach, within my what I can fathom with my hands. Whatever's there most, I look at what are the top three items that I keep in my space. Now, you don't write down what you think it should be, what it ought to be, what you hope it will be, what you wish it would be. Those are not real. What's real is what you have, what your life is demonstrating. And sometimes I have a daughter who's a fashion designer. She makes all my clothes, DeMartini clothes. So in her space is fashion, you know, designs, clothes, fabrics, shoes, everything that's in fashion, photos, magazines. So you look at, I have another daughter who's also a teacher. She has an easel, books, computer. Your life reveals what you value most. in your space. So the first thing is, what are the top three items that you fill your most intimate space with most and your personal space with most? Most consistently looking at the space you spend most of your time in. And then look at what is primary, the use of those items. What is the primary purpose and use of why you have those items there? Not secondary uses, but primary uses. So that's one. That gives an indication. And even a baby in a baby crib, if you throw something in there, if it doesn't want it there, it will scream and kick and push it away. If it wants it there, it'll explore it and put it in its mouth and look at it and hold on to it. So even a baby has a proximic and has some value. The second value determination is time. You find time, make time, and spend time on things that are valuable to you. And you don't want to take time. You avoid things and distract yourself from the time doing something up. There's many people who come up to you and said, look, would you like to do this? And you go, oh, no, thank you. I've got so much to do. And then somebody else comes up and asks if you want to do something that's really important. And you go, here, let me stop what I'm doing. I'll join you. So we find time and make time for things that are really valuable to us. And even though we say, well, I don't have time for doing things, whatever you are doing is obviously valuable enough to make a preference, because every decision you make is based on your values. And you obviously think that what you're doing has got more value than something else, even though you swear it's got to be not it. I have people say, well, I hate my job, but I got to go to work. No, you're not going to work for that job. You're going to work for possibly your financial security, and that you won't give up. That's why you're at that job every day. So we just got to be really clear what you're really doing at that job. So you look at what you spend your time on, the top three things you spend your time on most. And this just means most consistently you're spending your time on. Now, I'll be speaking, I mean, this is the fourth podcast today, and I've done a consult and a webinar this morning, and I still got two more podcasts. So my day is teaching, and I do it every day. So if I look at what I spend most of my time on, it's teaching. The second most, it's researching and writing. I'm writing another book while I'm in between my presentations. And if I look, I don't seem to have time for some things that aren't important to me. I just don't make time for it. So some people ask me, you want to go socializing and do this? Thank you, but I've got a conference, thank you. So if you look carefully and are honest with yourself, your time will reveal what's important to you. And there will be a pattern. If I look at how I spend my time, it's teaching. If I look at what I'm doing with my space, it's materials for teaching. So there'll be a congruent pattern that's emerging right away, if you're honest. The third one is energy. You grow energy when you're doing something high in your values, and you drain energy if you don't. So your energy goes up in your highest values, it goes down in your lowest. If somebody's talking at a social event or a party or something, and they're talking about something boring, you'll yawn and you'll try to keep it from yawning. You'll go to your fellows and go, boring. But the second the conversation gets into something that's highest on your value, you're engaged, you forget about sleep, you forget what time it is, and you're there. So your energy goes up when you're doing something high in your value, energy goes down. So what is the top three things that energizes you most? And when you're doing it, you have more energy than when you started at the end of it. So mine is teaching. I have strange hours. I'm in every time zone around the world. And I'll go from one time zone to the other and coordinate it. I just found out a minute ago I'm flying to London from Turkey. And then I'm going back into the Middle East. And I'm doing that in about a 40-hour period. And I'm doing two different time zones. I'm speaking in Australia on one of them when I get back. And so I'm going to be going all morning and day and then all night. So I do crazy hours because it energizes me getting to do what I do. So the next one is energy. How do you spend your energy? And what is it makes you have energy the most? The fourth one is money. You find money, make money, spend money on things that are really valuable to you. And you don't want to spend money on things that don't value. So you got people that will spend money on food and other people will not spend hardly anything on food. Some will buy a big house and spend their money on it. Some go, no, I don't need a house. I don't. And some will buy a car and some will people buy clothes and some people invest. The hierarchy of your values dictates your financial destiny. Tell me where your money goes by looking at your disbursement sheet and I'll tell you where your values are, because your money is going to go. Now, most of my money when I was in my 20s went to buying books and to paying for education, professional education. Kind of tells you what's going down. And now, because a lot of it's online, I don't have to buy as many books and I don't have to go and pay for education. I'm getting paid to educate. So now most of it goes into investments and philanthropy. So most of my money I get goes into those things. So I look at what my values are. It reveals by how I spend my money. The fifth one is where you're most organized and ordered. See, I can see then behind you that you have an aesthetic. You like things aesthetically, you know, positioned perfectly. Yes. And so you have a value on that. And so in the process of doing it, where is it that you have the greatest degree of order and organization? Is it your workout routine? Is it the way you present yourself? Is it your environment? Is it your financial management? Is it your business management? Is it the way you manage your kids? Is it your spiritual rituals? Where are you highly organized and ordered? The top three areas of your life. And many people compare themselves to others and then go, well, I don't have the order they have, so I don't have order. I'm not asking where you don't have order. I'm asking where you do have order. Everybody has order and organization in their highest values. So you find that. Now, mine is teaching. I've got organized. I got hundreds of thousands of pages of notes and written notes that I've done that's organized. And my computer is vastly organized on knowledge. So it's the same thing. What I teach, my teaching is organized. I got 80 classes that I'm teaching and thousands of presentations. They're all organized. Man, they're literally structured. So look at where you're most organized. The next one is where you're most disciplined. What do you do spontaneously that nobody has to remind you to do? Nobody has to remind you to do it. You just do it. Now, I'm spontaneously teaching and researching and writing. And I travel because I live on a ship that goes around the world. So I'm constantly traveling, going country to country to country. So those are pretty high in my value, enough for me to live full-time traveling and enough for me to come full-time teaching. So I look carefully at what it is that I am spontaneously disciplined and you can rely on me to be doing it. You can't rely on me to be going to social party. You can't rely on me to play in football, but you can rely on me to be research and teaching. You can guarantee that's what John will be doing. So you look at where you're spontaneously disciplined. The next one is, what do you think about how you would love your life to be that shows evidence coming true? What are you thinking about most about how you would love your life to be that shows evidence coming true? I think most about teaching across the world. I made a commitment to touch 7 billion people's lives. We're over 6 now. So I basically said, I'm going to do that. I'm not going to stop until 7 billion people have reached a message with radio, television, newspaper, magazines, movies, every possible vehicle that's out there. So what is it that you think about how you would love your life to be that shows evidence of coming true? If there's no evidence, you can't write it. If it's not something you love, you can't write it. If people want to write down what's not happening, their fantasies, right? Or they're writing down what they don't want to happen. That's not the question. What is it you would love, you think about that you would, what you would love to do that shows evidence coming true? The next one is, what are you visualizing? Because the thinking is mainly the frontal cortex and part of the parietal. Visualizing is the occipital cortex. What are you visualizing about how you would love your life to be that shows evidence of coming true? Well, I see myself going to major countries. I used to cut out pictures from the internet of the great theaters, the great convention halls, the great hotel ballrooms, and literally cut pictures out of those places and see those per city. And I took all the major cities that had 3 million people or more in the cities. I cut out and got a list of them and I put pictures next to them and saw myself literally in those ballrooms in my mind. And they're coming true. It's amazing how it comes true if you see it. So what are you visualizing about how you would love your life to be that shows evidence coming true?
Hey there, it's Julie. Okay, just pausing really briefly to make sure you knew about my free intuition quiz. I don't want to give away the 4 intuitive types, but as you know, your intuition is the gateway to having your own inner GPS to navigate all you're seeking in life. This free quiz will only take you 2 minutes, and it will totally help you discover your specific intuitive superpowers
and how to tap into your USU. It will reveal your exact intuitive type and how to unlock it and use it like a pro. You can take my free quiz at julieriesler.com/free quiz. And definitely let me know what your dominant intuitive type is.
The next one is, what are you internally dialoguing with yourself about? What is your internal affirmation about how you would love your life to be that shows evidence coming true? Now, that's the auditory cortex on the sides, temporal. So I'm looking at the whole brain. What is it most congruently thinking about, visualizing, affirming about how it would love its life to be that shows congruency and coming true? The next one is, what do you keep wanting to bring conversations to when you interact with people? You know, when somebody comes up to you and they have a high value in kids, they go, how's your kids? They have a high value in business, like, how's your business? And how's your golf game? How's your investments? How's your travels? They're going to project onto you their values. What is it that you consistently want to converse with other people about most? And if you get to converse about it, you come alive. You know, mind's human behavior, obviously, right? Anything to do with maximizing human beings on the planet, I'm engaged. But if you start talking about how to, the recipe of how to make spaghetti or something like that, I haven't cooked since I was 24, I haven't driven a car since I was 32. I don't do those things. I delegate anything that's low on my values, I delegate to other people who would love doing it, so I can surround myself with people who love doing what they do, so I can go do what I love to do. So what exactly is it that you want to converse with other people about most? And that tells you, and there's a pattern. If you're doing this accurately, there'll be a clear pattern showing up all through these answers on these top three. The next one is, what is it that you have that inspires you? What inspires you most? And what's common to the people who have inspired you most? Well, if I look at the people who have inspired me most, it's been the great philosophers, the great Nobel Prize winners, the people who have done extraordinary things on the planet and done things that people said was an enigma. How did they accomplish that? I love studying their lives, extracting their experiences, reflecting and seeing those in me, and contributing that knowledge out. So that's what brings tears to my eyes. So what is it brings tears to your eyes? Because those are moments of authenticity and moments of inspiration. They're guides to doing something extraordinary with your life. And identify the top three things that most inspire you. And two more, the next one is, what are the three most consistent, persistent goals you have that you've pursued and have shown evidence of coming true? They're either in motion or already achieved. The three most consistent things. I wanted to teach. I have evidence of that. I wanted to travel the world. I have evidence of that. I wanted to research and write. I have a lot of evidence of that. There's over 300 books I've written. There's actually 43 that are out now just in personal development, but there's a whole lot of textbooks. So I have evidence of that. So I look at those evidence because that tells you what you really made a commitment to. Because a lot of times people have fantasies, well, I want to do this, I want to do that, but then there's no evidence. And the last one is, what is it you spontaneously want to learn about, read about, study, and fill your mind with? What is it you constantly want to do? Now, I sense that you probably love inspiration, spiritual awareness, maximizing human awareness, and being present and being communicated with the intelligence of the universe kind of thing. I'm assuming that's a pretty high value in your life. So your life will demonstrate that, right? And you will feel that there is a communion going on between the universal field of intelligence in the universe, the panpsychic intelligence, and our own physiological feelings in our heart. So there'll be a connection there, and that will be what you love studying. Any book that's out, any writer, speaker, whatever, you'll probably absorb that and devour that on YouTube or whatever. But what do you want to feed your mind and educate yourself with? And the top three things. And if I look at the consistency in that pattern and all those answers, and then what you do is you add three answers for 13 questions, there's 39 answers, and you look at which answer showed up most frequent, second most frequent, third most frequent, and that'll tell you your top three values. And I've been doing this for quite a while, and it's way more solid than just asking what are your values, and people will tell you BS. They'll say truth and peace and honesty and everything else. But then I'm not interested in that. I'm interested, those are social idealisms. I'm interested in what your life demonstrates. What are you really doing with your life? Because your hierarchy of values is making your decisions, your perceptions, and your actions. I want that. Now, once we know that, we can start structuring by priority and filling our day with high priority things and learning the art of being of service, doing something that makes a difference in other people's lives, to be remunerated for doing that in a sustainable, fair manner, so you can do what you love and love what you do and delegate all lower priority things. That's the path of mastery.
Okay. I'm in the space of both listening deeply and of course was thinking, oh my gosh, I'm going to do this. As you were speaking, first of all, you were spot on with myself. I'm like, how does he know? He knows because you've been doing this for so many years. I love the depth of what you're saying. This is not, and I'll tell you, because when I did my whole, I did a degree in coaching, we learned about values and strengths, the VIA strengths, you look at the list, like that is one thing. But what you're talking about, what I love is this is at the deepest level, and look what you're doing. Look at how your actions are supporting what you're saying are your values. My question is, because I went through a period, I'll just keep it really short, where I realized the energy that I was feeling in my life was not matched to what I could feel at a very deep level was the direction I wanted to go. And it looked like a massive breakdown, massive, that led to my choosing to do things like leave a job, get out of a marriage, good person, not the right fit, two young kids, health breakdown. It's one of the biggest gifts. Because I think what I just got when you were speaking is I realized I was not living aligned truly with my, what I would call, right, my meest me, the youest you values. So I'm curious, when I'm sure you've worked with many people that realize, oh crap, this is not reflecting the way that I want to live. And I know for me, it was a huge wake up call. I'm today speaking to you. I'm like, this is part of what I want to be doing, because I love sharing wisdom and the spirit with all of us. So how do we, for those listening that are like, I'm really not aligned. It's not where I want it to be. What do we do then, Dr. Demartini?
Well, can I share a story to help?
Oh, God, share as many stories as you'd like. Yes.
So I was teaching the Breakthrough Experience, which is one of my signature programs, which I've done 1,160 times. Done a lot of them.
Okay, a lot of those.
Because I keep records of all the countries and stuff. And so cool. There was a gentleman that came in who was, late 40, early 50s, I guess. And he was depressed. And he was overweight and already balding and was a lawyer, and his father told him he had to be a lawyer. His mother and father told him who he had to marry, because there's a nice Jewish family, and he had to be, you have to marry what parents pressure you to do, part of the community. And he had to go to school and study what he was doing, in other words. And he wanted to fit in. He wanted to be a good, Jewish boy. But all of a sudden, when he hit this late 40 mark, there was something happened. His father died. Mm-hmm. Most of his life, he tried to please his father. He wanted approval from his father. Now, that's his own illusion, because we get it in forms, we don't always see it. We don't get it in our way, we get it the way they projected on their own, from their own values, the parents. When his father died, the drive to try to do all those things just stopped. It just, all of a sudden, he felt this, I can't do this anymore. His mother didn't really have an issue. It was mainly the father. Mother just did what the father said, kind of thing. Mother was more supportive. The father was more, this is the way to do it. Mm. All of a sudden, he couldn't do the work anymore. He said, I just can't do this anymore. And by then, because he had gained weight, hit hypertension. And right after his father died, he had a heart attack. because he was going and doing something he didn't love to do, which creates a cytokine kind of imbalance. You have a pro-inflammatory and anti-inflammatory, and they get out of balance if you're under distress all the time. He had a heart attack. It wasn't a severe enough to kill him by anything, but it was enough to wake him up. And then all of a sudden, he just couldn't go to work, and his business nosedived. He ended up going bankrupt. So now he has a bankruptcy. He has a heart attack. And he's not making any money. And his wife says, you know, you have to provide for all the kids. And he just says, I can't do this anymore. I can't do that job anymore. But he had such a comfort from that income, and he extended himself where he's living beyond his means to please the wife and please the family and everything else and give money to this and that, that when he went down, he was in debt. Mm. So he goes bankrupt, shuts down his business. His wife leaves him. So his wife takes the kids and says, what a man. You're not a man. You're not taking care of me. Goes and lives with the family with all the kids, which I'm sure was an interesting experience. So he's now losing his confidence in himself. He's got a heart attack he's recovered from. He's lost his bankruptcy. He's depressed. He doesn't want to go to work and do that anymore. And he's feeling like a failure. And he comes to this program. Somebody told him, go to the program. And he started telling me this story. So he was angry at God, as he called it. He was now intellectually feeling defeated because he felt like he's a failure. His business is bankrupt. His relationship is down. He's got no money. Socially, he's being rejected for what's happening. And he's angry at God, as he perceived. Now, he created sort of an anthropomorphic idea in his mind of what God was, and there's a punishing, rewarding kind of God instead of a universal presence. But that's how his structure was. So he comes to me and he's depressed. He wants to run this story, run this racket. I said, stop. Sounds like the greatest day of your life. He said, what? What? I just told you a story. How can you say such a thing? This is crazy. I said, I can tell from your body language, your physiology, and your way you're speaking, and all the language you use, and all the shoulds and got tos and have tos and must and need tos, and all the imperative languages that are coming out of your mouth, that you've been living trying to please your dad. When he died, you have no more reason to do it. And everything crumbled in order to get out of that the kind of hell you're in. And he looked at me and he goes, wow. I said, this is the greatest day of your life. You now can go do what you really want to do. What do you really want to do? He looked at me and he goes, wow, I've never given myself permission to do that. He started crying. He says, I have a love for cars. I really want to buy and sell cars and fix up cars, fancy, unique cars. That's what I wanted to do since I was a kid. I said, then give yourself permission to do it. And he did. He moved to Florida where he could sell cars and not dress in the suit, to go ahead and dress a little bit more casual in a warm environment. And he ran into another woman, a little bit younger, not much younger, 5 years younger. He started a new life, started making better money, doing something he loved to do, lost a bunch of weight. His heart recovered because he started exercising because the new girlfriend was wanting him to exercise and then keep him in shape. He turned his life left field and started giving himself permission to do what was true in his life instead of trying to force himself to please one man. He spent his life trying to please his dad. Anytime we subordinate to mothers, fathers, or preachers, or teachers, or conventions, or traditions, or mores, and try to fit into the crowd, and try to blend into it, we just lost our power to make a difference. And we just lost our own identity. And the old saying, I'd rather hold the whole world against me than my own soul. Mm. And he gave up his soul, in a sense, to please the masses of people and the communities and his father and everybody else. And he finally gave himself permission to do what he loved to do. By the end of the program, he put his arms around me and he says, now I know I want to go back to the guy that told him to come here. Because he knew something would come about being here. And right now I see clearly what I want to do. And I got out of a marriage I didn't want to be in without having to pay upon a bundle because I was bankrupt. I got out of a job I didn't want to do, and I would never have left it unless I'd bankrupted it. I would never have left it because it was too comfortable paying for everything. And I would have probably died with a heart attack. This saved my life. There's not one thing I can't say thank you for right now. I am so grateful. I can't believe I couldn't see that, but now I can see it. And I'm very grateful that I had unconsciously created these scenarios to liberate me from my false persona into my true identity.
Ooh, that's really profound. It's really profound what you're sharing here. And just really, I'm so touched and moved just listening to that story, you know, because even daring to tell him it's the best day of his life, which I can only imagine. He was like, this man is nuts. What am I doing here?
Exactly. That's how he started.
I'm signed up for what? Like, I'm
exactly
here to do what? Because it reminds me, you know, what you're saying. I so feel this, that it's so crucial. And I'm speaking to everybody listening and to myself that we have an inner guide, an inner soul calling, that no matter what anyone else thinks we should be doing or how we should be living, nothing, as you said, I forget the way that you said it, but nothing ever comes close to following our own soul and that guidance. That it just, I have chills. I'm actually have chills. I'm wearing a really hot sweater, so that says something. And I just, you know, your stand for this and teaching people how to do this. And to me, I mean, I'm just so grateful you listened to, you made that decision, is what you said in the beginning. You made a decision that you would never let anybody else or yourself get in the way. And I want to take that and, like, everybody just emblazon that in your mind, because this is what happens when you make a decision. I'm listening to you. I'm watching you. I was listening to you before we got on this call. And I'm like, what a beautiful human being you've decided and chosen to be. And I just, it's so inspiring to me. And I know to the man you spoke of, and I'm sure the millions, you said billions, 6 billion, moving to 7. I mean, this, and you know, what I'm getting too is it's going to look different for everyone. Cause we all have, like the man you said, he loved cars to polish them up, to refurbish. I don't know a thing about cars, so I probably didn't use the right words, but like he does, he knows what he's doing. And we all have something like that. And I just, what moves me is the idea of, God forbid the life ends, right? The heart attack happens. Again, and I have a feeling this is for you as well. Like, just the idea that you know, you, that I, anyone listening, you might miss the gold that's in you, the treasure. It's like, you know, what I'm hearing is not on my watch. That's not happening.
Ronnie Ware, who wrote The 5 Regrets of Dying, I had about a year ago, I had a lovely chat with her for about an hour. She was in Australia. And because I really liked her questions. You know, what people are actually regretting at their death.
Yeah.
And most of it was not being authentic, ultimately, boiled down to that. And so she supports what I'm doing, and I think that people deserve to watch what she's doing because it's made a difference. Can I share another story?
Oh, my gosh.
This was earlier this year. I got a call from South Africa, and a lady called me and says, I've got a client that has got a post-traumatic stress disorder as a result of being kidnapped and ransomed, his family, dealing with his family. Can you help me with that? I said, okay, I've done some of these. And so the guy gets on the Zoom, and he's a short guy about probably also 45, I guess, 46 maybe. And he started telling me a story. And the story was that he was driving down the freeway in his BMW. And it was crowded on the freeway, so things were moving slow. all of a sudden, four cars came on either side and surrounded him and pinned him in. And men got out with covered things, with machine guns, came to his thing, bashed out his window, opened the car, pulled him out, carried him, put something over his head, and stuck him in a back trunk of one of the cars. And then they drove off and left his car on the highway. Now, he was the CEO of a pretty good-sized company. And so he was known. And apparently they knew he had money. And so people thought, this is during the COVID. And during the COVID period, you know, people were, the rich and the poor were being stressed in that country. And he was a bit cocky and confident, arrogant. And so nature has a way of bringing things, as Emerson said, compensation brings things down. And so he spends 5 hours in a drive from the back of this trunk with fumes and darkness. And then it gets into this, look like a barn, a warehouse. And he spends 5.5 weeks there until he raises and gets the money to them. And they ask for a pretty substantial amount of money and threatened the family if they didn't provide it. So they had it all planned. It was premeditated. It was structured. So when he comes on the line on Zoom, I said, go to the moment where and when you're in shock. And from the moment they take you into the trunk. Good. Are you there? You're in the trunk? Great. In your moment, the way the brain is set up, whenever you have sensory receptors bringing information in, and then you associate it in your brain, you have a perception. And then that perception, whatever it is, if it is highly negatively charged and you can't fight it, you can't flight it, you'll freeze. And the polyvagal theory will make you dissociate and you'll create an anti-memory to counterbalance it, to bring homeostasis to the brain, to survive. So that means that whatever you perceive, the equal and opposite was in your brain in order to survive that event. So at that moment, when you're in that dark trunk, your mind had to create an anti-memory to do it. So go back to that moment, get present with it. Let's find out what it was. And all of a sudden, when he gets really present there and he's feeling trapped, he's seeing himself holding his wife's hand and his children's hands, and they're running in a field free with butterflies and sun is out, and they're just running through a beautiful field because he's feeling trapped here. And this is the associations he's made through his life of being free, running through a field. And birds are free and butterflies are free, uncontrolled, ungoverned. Then he says, well, I felt like I'm going to, the fumigation was smelling gasoline, perfume of flowers. He could smell flowers. He felt that he was, when he was in the trunk, that he's going to lose his family because it threatened his life and his family. So he's with them and they're alive and vibrant. Whatever he perceives, the equal and opposite associations from his experiences come into the brain in order to counterbalance it with an anti-memory as a dissociation in order to do it. You find this in rape cases and beatings and things. This happens every time. So when he saw that, he actually was brought to tears because he saw that the most ecstatic thing and the most traumatic thing, the torture and the ecstasy, were simultaneous. And he was holding on to one and conscious of the negatives and unconscious of the positives. And I brought him a question that made the unconscious available so he could be fully conscious. And in each moment, he found this pair of opposites and it brought him to a tear of gratitude. And I took a slice in the stream of consciousness moment by moment by moment through this trauma, through the entire time, just step by step, and found out these pairs of opposites. When all of a sudden he was there, they didn't feed him and he was starving. I took him to go to the moment when you felt really hungry. What was your mind doing? And he said he was imagining himself with his family and they were eating and he was playing with these pairs of opposites. And I took each one of those slivers over about an hour and 45 minutes and just neutralized them all until he goes, I don't feel the torture or trauma right now. I said, I know, because you're now fully aware of what was there. There's actually a magnificence going on, but we don't see it. And we label things. As Milton said, John Milton, we can make a heaven out of a hell or a hell out of a heaven. It's all a perception. And it's not what happens to us. It's our perceptions, decisions, and actions. So when I got through and I said, now, what's the benefit of them doing this and this ransom? He started stacking up benefits. He saw drawbacks. Therefore, he labeled it traumatic and terrible. I asked him, what are the benefits? He couldn't see any at first, but he started looking. And he goes, wow, I've never had, since I've been married, as much desire as I had at that time to want to hold on to my family, be with my family, and love my mom, my mother, my father, my brother, my sister, my kids, my wife. I've never, ever felt that much closeness to them. And it reawoke to me something I had buried that I didn't even know I had. I'm closer now to my wife and my kids than I've ever been in my life. And I can guarantee you that I took them for granted. I was focused on business. And when this happened, I really loved my family. And my wife was trying to give me hints. You know, wife is a consultant. You don't get to pay. It's trying to tell you, you know, your sixth sense, but you don't listen to it until it sometimes takes that type of an event. And then he said, so one of the blessings, I'm closer to my family. I lost a pile of weight. I had hypertension. I was a time bomb looking for an accident, you know, an accident looking to play for a heart attack. And while I was gone for those weeks, my company rose to the occasion, took command of the things that I've been wanting them to take command on. They had no choice but to do it. And the businesses flourished. And I made more money being gone than I normally do there because I'm in the way. And I was trying to run everybody else's thing and micromanage people instead of actually get onto what was most significant and to realize that. And so deep inside, I was feeling guilty about not being with my family. Deep inside, I was angry with the staff because they weren't rising to the occasion. But the truth was I was micromanaging them and keeping them suppressed. So once I got through this and I had to pay them out and I got taken home and dropped off. Well, I got dropped off in the middle of nowhere, but I made it home. I just, all I want to do is just hold my family and just say, thank you. I love you. And go to my staff and thank you. You ran the business. And when he found out that the business made more money than the cost of the ransom during the time he was gone, he all of a sudden realized that I feel like I want to write a thank you letter to them. They saved my life health-wise. They saved my marriage health-wise, which saved half of my fortune and saved my business and allowed me to do that. And made me authentic. And I'm now doing yoga and eating well. I have time to be with my kids and family. I know who they are. I've got a powerful team doing this. I couldn't have hired a consultant to get me that outcome. I was in my way. I'm now authentic to myself. And I was trying to prove myself over everybody else's in business to prove that I was great at what I was doing and I was in my way. So I right now want to thank those individuals that came, kind of like guardian angels came into my life to help me get back to what was true and authentic and not kill myself. And when he left there, he went back to his house, hugged his family, told them the whole thing. And they were going, their mouths were open. I got a beautiful letter from him saying, in 2 hours, you took a post-traumatic stress experience and turn it into a state of grace and thank you to want to actually appreciate the people that actually robbed me. They were not mistakes. They were exactly what I needed to get me where I was going.
Wow. Wow. That is quite a story. There is so much to unpack in that. I mean, just hearing that, first of all, the flip in perspective, like you said, you know, it's all perception and to be able, I mean, it's even as you said, these angels, it's like, we don't know from this angle, you know, when things happen, our soul hasn't designed that for a greater wake up. That's what I'm just taking away is.
Everything that goes on in our life, physiologically, psychologically, sociologically, theologically, yeah. Business-wise, every symptom is a feedback mechanism to guide us to authenticity.
Can you say that one more time? Because that is...
Every physiological symptom Yeah. I've been studying physiology. I just finished just a few days ago doing a five-day program on 1,000 health conditions and the psychology minor and the physiology, neurology, endocrinology. You know, I mean, I've gone down to the nth degree of the quantum level with this. Every one of the symptoms of our body epigenetically that are being expressed autonomically is a feedback trying to get us to be authentic. The second we're puffed up and arrogant and not communicating effectively in other people's values, or minimizing ourselves and sacrificing, trying to get something for nothing or give something for nothing, we'll create symptoms to get us back into fair exchange and to authenticity, where we have, where the seer, the seeing, and the seen is the same across the reflective awareness of society. And the moment we get back there, our symptoms go. And the symptoms in our relationship, and the symptoms in our mind, and the symptoms in our business transactions, and the symptoms in our social interactions, and our relationship with the universe, the feeling of flow, all trying to get us back to authenticity.
Mm. That is our drop the mic moment. That I just, you know, I'm gonna, that is so beyond powerful. And I can just say, personally speaking, this came to me intuitively with my own symptom health issue. It was a clear, I heard it like, yeah, it's your throat chakra. That's your throat. That is, you're not speaking up. And I have, you know, mine has been thyroid, and I'm like, oh, it's all, it regulates everything.
I just got through in my program. The thyroid gland originates from the thyroglossal duct. On top of the tongue is the foramen cecum, which is the remnant of an kind of an evagination that turns into a thyroglossal duct and divides into two lobes with an isthmus. And in the thyroid gland, because it originates from the tongue, it is involved in metabolism, energy level. It's also speech. So people who are holding back what they want to say lower the thyroid. And people that are saying something they wish they hadn't said raise the thyroid. So people that are speaking out tactlessly, their thyroids go up. If those that are holding back and worrying about, see, anytime we depend on somebody and we're afraid to lose them and we don't want to upset them because we don't want to be only positive and don't want to make anything a negative or whatever, we'll hold that back and the thyroid will let us know it. So our metabolism will go down because we're not, whenever we are playing support and not challenge, the metabolism go down. When you're in challenge, the sympathetic comes on, it raises heart rate, raises temperature, and raises everything up, thyroid goes up. So the body will give us symptoms to let us know and why those glands do that. And the second, I just worked with one just yesterday. They had Raynaud's syndrome, which is coolness of fingers. They had a myositis and a creatine kinase that was down because the muscles were deteriorating. There was some eyesight involvement. And each of these things were all a result of hypothyroidism. And all she wanted to do is to cuss at this principal that she was a school teacher at the school at. She was so upset at the school teacher. She just wanted to do it, but she can't do that because I'll lose my job. Yeah. And so she was just suppressing what she was doing, and her thyroid was just boom. And so we addressed that yesterday, told her exactly what to do to dissolve the anger towards him so she doesn't have to express that. She can express love and appreciation, and that won't cause a problem with thyroid. That will normalize it. And help her realize that she doesn't go on wild goose chase because she's spending thousands of dollars on diagnostic tests trying to figure out what's going on. It's just a derivative of repressing what she's actually wanting to do. So it's so true.
Wow. Well, that was helpful on this end. And I actually know a lot of listeners I've done a lot on thyroid and what I've learned in that lesson and many that have struggled with it. I'm not surprised many women who've struggled with
very common.
Yeah.
Women, very common. I saw a pattern. Women that were getting married young, had a bit of a fantasy that their man's going to be there helping out with the children, who sacrificed a career path and all of a sudden feel like, my God, is this it? This is not what I was expecting. Yeah. And then all of a sudden he's now having to work more. And so there's a difference between the kiddos and the work. And then there's a fear of, I have to depend on them. From an income, all these things, these patterns are very common in thyroid patients. And then what happens, you put on a bit of weight to protect yourself from getting pregnant again so you don't have further craziness. and you end up lowering the metabolism and drying out the hair and all the basic things that go with the squinty eyes, all the things that happen from the thyroid. And all that changes if we go back and get back on track. And I'm sure you've seen the metabolism go back up and your energy go up and your shape goes back and everything starts to kick into gear again.
100%. And, you know, intuitively, when I had this diagnosis, this is like 12 years ago, at the height of the wake up sit call for me, what I heard my intuition say is, I did hear I'd been studying chakras and it's your throat chakra, which I heard is you have not been speaking up. You've not been, oh, it makes me want to cry. Which is partially into, you know, I've like only cried once on here, but I part of doing this show is A, not just to speak my voice, but to have voices speaking that's empowering. That's all like literally what you were talking about today. I'm like, oh my goodness, this is what my throat, my voice wants to be sharing. And so just being vulnerable, I know we're still recording. I'd normally be like, stop, I'll share this after, but it's all right. Everyone's with me. We've been together now for 350 plus episodes. We'll continue. I actually was asking myself, you know, I was actually asking myself as you talked about this, where am I still not speaking up? It's doing great and I've well managed it and it's not completely healed. And I just know intuitively, I'm like, there's still some things I'm not completely saying. And I've seen it, I've lived it. What you're saying, this is true. And I'm saying this because everyone listening, if you have symptoms, like really what you're sharing, I know this to be true. There is a message in there. And we're so divinely designed. We really are, if we're listening and paying attention. And yeah, I'm feeling like, wow, there is definitely a greater intelligence that brought us here today. This is, if I could tell myself 12 years ago, it's going to be okay, is how I'm feeling.
Well, whenever we compare our actions to somebody else's values, we're not going to appreciate ourselves.
Yeah.
Whenever we compare other people's actions to our values, we're not going to appreciate them. And if we spend our life doing that, we're not going to appreciate life. Mm. We're going to depreciate. And we're not going to feel our magnificence. But when we realize that people make decisions according to their values and we make decisions according to ours, and we honor our values and learn how to articulate what we would love to do in terms of what their values are so they can get win too, which is caring enough to communicate what you value in terms of what other people value. Now we master the game. When we do, we don't have people interfering with what we're going to do. They're winning out of it. And so we then, it starts to grow and we can see the impact that it naturally grows. It's organically. I say you're at the right place at the right time to meet the right people to do the right deal. It just starts to open up. So giving ourselves permission to be authentic is one of the most liberating truths in a world that's trying to get you to fit in. You have to be willing to stand out.
I cannot thank you enough for being here today, for making this decision 50 years ago. I keep feeling like, thank God you did. And for the work you're doing, for what you shared here, you've touched my life, not exactly 50 years. I haven't been on the planet yet that long, but for a long time, especially today. And I know for everyone listening in, and I really acknowledge and honor you, Dr. DeMartini, because I just think of your story. I go back to that, what you were told, the dunce cap, and just completely saying, no, that is not what's happening here. I am going to help billions and really stand for that no matter what. And just really thankful for you. This has been such a gift to chat with you here. Thank you.
Well, thank you for having me on the show and giving me the opportunity to do it because, you know, my goal was to reaching people, but if I don't have people like you helping me reach people, I don't get my goal. So we're helping each other. So thank you. You're helping me fulfill my mission today. So thank you.
I'm so honored to be a part of your journey.
Thank you for listening to this episode, and I hope it inspires you to remember who you really are and who you chose to be in this lifetime. If you're interested in becoming your USU, I would love to guide you. Please check out my website for additional information on how we can work together. And if you feel moved, please subscribe, rate, and review this podcast so that more big-hearted individuals can find these inspiring conversations. Here's to being and loving your USU.